Broadcasting from the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., welcome to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and my co-host for today's show is Dr. Anthony Wanese St. John. He is the main instructor and the author of the online course, Negotiation, Shaping the Conflict Landscape, which the Global Campus has been offering during the month of February. So, Anthony, as always, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you and with our guest, Grandlam.
Wonderful. Now, this year marks the 50th anniversary of the historic march in Selma, Alabama, here in the United States, that helped pave the way for the 1965 Voting Rights Act, a moment that was captured in the film Selma. This year also marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, a civil rights leader who helped shape conceptions of Black identity here in the United States. These two moments in the American story are prime examples of how culture and identity have been at the center of some of the most transformative multi-party conflicts in the United States. We fast forward to current events, and we mourn the lives of the three Muslim students who were murdered in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. We follow and listen to the protests and demonstrations in Ferguson, Missouri, and other cities around the country that have grown in response to police violence against communities of color. And we see many other conflicts concerning culture and identity. As these communities that are experiencing conflict seek to move forward, negotiation and mediation processes are ongoing, and they are trying to create agreements, policies, and responses that address the issues at hand. This is the last week of the negotiation course, and we are looking at aspects of cross-cultural and multi-party negotiations. How do negotiations work that are part of conflicts that emerge in part due to cultural differences and issues related to identity? How do negotiations work that involve multiple parties at different levels, from the local grassroots organizer to the federal law enforcement agency? Joining us remotely from his office to help us explore these kinds of negotiations is our guest, Grand Lum. Grand is the director of the Community Relations Service at the United States Department of Justice. Grand has extensive expertise in dispute resolution, including providing mediation, facilitation, and training. He has worked with students and educators, diplomats and community leaders, law enforcement, government officials, attorneys, scientists, and business executives. Before joining CRS, Grand was a clinical professor at the University of California Hastings School of Law, where he directed the Center for Negotiation and Dispute Resolution. Prior to his tenure at Hastings School of Law, he was the founder of Accordance, a dispute resolution training firm, a principal of ThoughtBridge, a mediation firm, and a partner with the consulting firm Conflict Management Incorporated. His published works include the Negotiation Field Book, which is currently in its second edition. Grand, thank you so much for taking the time today to be with us on the show.
Darren and Anthony, thank you for having me. I've been very much looking forward to this.
Wonderful. And we're also joined by our many listeners from around the world who we invite to engage with our guest and help guide the conversation. Our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis, will be moderating your questions and comments throughout the show. Vanessa, are you able to give us a hello?
Hey, everyone. We have some longtime listeners joining us today, so I'm looking forward to your questions and comments throughout the show.
So when you have a question or comment, all you need to do is notify Vanessa by clicking the little raise hand button on your control panel, and Vanessa will get you queued up. She'll let you know when you're about to go on air, and then she'll unmute you and bring you into the show so you can share your question or comment directly. If you don't have a microphone on your computer, you can instant message Vanessa by typing your question or comment into the question box on your control panel, and then Vanessa will read it for you on air. So with that, let's get started. Now, before we jump into the specifics of your work, Grand, we like to give our listeners a window into who our guests are beyond their professional work and professional title. So we do an exercise called 3-2-1, which involves a series of questions that are intended to reveal a little bit about your personality, your motivations, and your interests. So, first question is, what are three things that people might be surprised to learn about you?
First of all, Darren, I love these questions. So three things that I think people might be surprised to learn about me would be, one, I sing in my church choir. Two, I've been doing yoga for almost 25 years. And three, I grew up a big Marvel comic book collector long before it was cool, long before it's become a worldwide phenomenon. So I have the entire Avengers collection from 1 to 200+, basically.
Ooh, wow. Now, you're actually the second guest we've had as part of the negotiation course that does yoga. We had a guest, Andre Harrison from ICRC, who was also an avid practicer of yoga. So the second question is, what are two things that you like to do outside of your profession, I guess beyond yoga and reading comics?
Well, one thing I really enjoy doing, which I've done for the last few years, is coach my son's basketball team. It's actually great to see kids get better and improve based on feedback and to see the joy that they have when they create a competency and a love for something. So that's one thing I do. The second one, since you didn't preclude me from going there, is that I like to sing karaoke on top of my church choir.
Awesome. If you have a little time at the end of the show, we might...
I don't think we want to harm the listeners in any way like that.
Awesome. Okay. And then the last question is, if you could have dinner with anyone, past or present, dead or alive, who would that person be?
So I struggled with this when I got the question. I was definitely thinking of going down the innovator, scientist who changed the world perspective, the Curries and the Thomas Edisons. And there's a part of me that really wants to see how do we solve today's problems. But I'm going to go with Mahatma Gandhi in terms of a person who focused on nonviolence as a means of resolving issues peacefully. It's a person who certainly has been the inspiration. You talked about the civil rights movement and was certainly an important thought leader and guide to that. And certainly, even as we face today's problems, as some of the ones you mentioned around what went on in North Carolina, for example, and in terms of the problems that we have today, I would really enjoy. I think, and he struck me as a person that I would have a very friendly, collegial conversation if I sat down and had dinner with.
Man, I'm liking you more and more with every question here, Grant. Anthony, I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you. Grant, you've been involved in researching negotiation, writing about it, training others, helping others to resolve their own conflicts through mediation for perhaps, I'm just guessing, 2 decades or thereabouts.
You're dating both of us at this point.
Absolutely. And both of us have known some inspirational figures, such as the late Roger Fisher, Bill Urey, and others from our time in Boston. I would love to ask you if you could tell our listeners some of the inspirational figures in the conflict management world from that time or more recently, people who have inspired you to do what you do today.
Well, thanks, Anthony. And it's a pleasure to be here with you, certainly. And I'd start with Roger Fisher, the person that you mentioned first. I would not be doing the work I'm doing now but for him. I took his class in my first year of law school in 1988, and it blew me away. Here was this guy who said, call me Roger, unlike the rest of the professors, who had flip charts everywhere, and we were expected to role play and brainstorm, and it was totally counter to what I was expecting in the negotiation course. I thought it was going to be about how to bang the table, how to beat the other side, how to intimidate the other party, and it wasn't about that. And moving forward from that, he welcomed students into a community there, and it was one of the few places I found the Harvard Law School campus at which I felt welcomed and that I really gained something out of, and it really gave me a perspective. I remember when I first became a teaching fellow, And he had in the class, we had folks from all around the world, but what I particularly remember was this was around the time of apartheid and the falling of that, and there were people from the African National Congress who, because he was training both sides, the government officials and the African National Congress, there were people there, and that was just so inspiring, and I felt it was a place that I could make a difference. I'd also add into that Bruce Patton, who really was his chief operating officer. Of course, he was the co-author, eventual co-author of Getting to Yes, as a person who really personally welcomed me into that and helped create a career for me, really. The last person, I want to jump forward, and a person that I've talked to a couple times, I had the chance to interview him, actually, for the 50th anniversary of CRS, because CRS, and we'll get that to a little bit later, was created by the 1964 Civil Rights Act. But I had a chance to interview Andrew Young. I also had the chance, I spent an hour talking with him. We were in Texas for the 50th anniversary of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and he took basically an hour just to talk to me. He did not know who I was at that point. I introduced myself to him, and he is, I'm not sure he is given enough credit as one of the, I would say, greatest negotiators of the 20th century and multifaceted. He was the primary civil rights negotiator for Martin Luther King in Birmingham, in Selma, and I'll talk a little bit about it later. He was, and he has such a wonderful sense about him that basically he felt people are people and that you could work things out. He, of course, goes from there to becoming the mayor of Atlanta, where he helps negotiate to get the Olympics, where he brings in billions of dollars and helps Atlanta grow. And of course, he becomes the UN ambassador and he does international negotiations. You would be hard pressed to find someone who has been so successful as a negotiator in those three worlds, I would say. And he just came across so well to me, and he was just incredibly good at providing guidance. So those are three people I would put forward from the negotiation world.
That's a great list, and I'll always remember Roger's kindness and willing to accept people into his office to just chat about what they thought would be the next great idea. He was always willing to listen to people. Mm-hmm. And Andrew Young, getting in trouble for wanting to bring Palestinians and Israelis together, based on the common sense idea that you only make peace with your enemies, not with your friends. So right. I'll always have some admiration for Andrew Young as well. Just probably like as for you, there were probably some critical aha moments in my own education on negotiation and mediation. And one of them came from my very first negotiation class, which was at Tufts, taught by Jeff Rubin, who worked closely with Roger. And we were doing an exercise that both you and I know called oil pricing, which I recall playing in each move as a very zero-sum competitive sort of chess game type interaction in which my very life depended on getting as much out of each round. And when Jeff debriefed the exercise, my team probably had come in dead last and we had lost valuable opportunities all because of our win-lose mentality. I was a bit humiliated, a bit confused. And now you and I have used that same exercise probably thousands of times since those days. And the lessons from it are still very close to my heart. And I wonder if you had some interesting inspirational moments too, where something sunk in for you very, very deeply and memorably.
Well, I certainly still remember the first time I did oil pricing in Roger's class in 1989. And you're right. It's a wonderful simulation because it replicates and creates true human emotion and challenges, and it provides that opening to learning. So the one that came to mind for me, especially since Anthony has the instructor in this online course, I remember an exercise that I did and consistently when I taught negotiation, which was just asking the students to go out into the world, go to your local store or go to a professor or whatever and negotiate something, right? And try to use something, a tool or a method that you've learned in the class. And the one I remember was the student whose name was Andrea. She went to her sister, and she had had this real difficult interaction because her mother, Andrea's mother, was giving away her jewelry. And Andrea was really upset because she thought she deserved this ring that had been given originally by their father. And the mother explained that she felt like this was something that the other daughter deserved as the younger daughter. And every time Andrea talked to her sister about it, it would end up badly. They would end up in an argument. So they actually stopped talking about it, and she just held a grudge against her sister. But because of this class, she went to her sister and said, I'm going to just focus on understanding and not get it, try my best not to get into an argument. So Andrea goes to her sister and basically asks, I want to talk about this ring. Can you just tell me why it's so important that you have this? And at first, the sister's very defensive about it because they're likely to replay the conflict that they've had before. After a couple of times of this, and Andrea's working really hard to not get upset, finally the sister says, you know, I just wanted the diamond. I'm about to get married. I want the diamonds for the ring. And at that point, Andrea is shocked. And she basically says she started crying because what she then says is, I never wanted the diamond. I just want the setting. I just loved it. I could care less about that diamond. And this, of course, is a similar analog to the famous orange story, right? Where one sister wants the peel and one sister wants the orange. And again, it's probably a story that we've shared many times, or one version of it. But it struck me like wow, here's something that actually made a huge difference for Andrea, and it changed the whole sort of trajectory of her relationship with her sister. And it just reminded me that as trite or as cliched as they sound, these things make a difference to people in these family situations, but then in the domestic community-based conflict situations that I've worked with, or the international situations, not always so cleanly, but we've got to remember that it does make a difference.
That's a beautiful story. And this is the Andrea that we both know, who's co-authored stuff with Roger.
This is a different Andrea. She's a student of mine.
Thank you.
Grand, you became the director of the CRS in 2012, and as we mentioned at the start of the show, there's a number of domestic conflicts here in the United States involving race, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, where CRS has been called in to help mediate. When and how does this call for a CRS presence and assistance happen when these conflicts emerge? Does a kind of a CRS bat signal go out? How does that process work?
Basically, we have 15 offices around the country, and it works not so dissimilarly from how other mediators work. We either offer our services and the parties accept it, or parties request our services. And we're part of the Department of Justice, and we have relationships, certainly, and a knowledge of us in communities throughout the country. And that's how we have it. We certainly have we have analysts who look at situations, and they pass them along so we can then make an inquiry into them. What we call conciliators, actually, the official title of the personnel of our mediators is conciliator. They will go out and assess the situation. They will make contact with parties involved, and then they will then make some provision of some offering of services, whether it's mediation, a facilitation of dialogue, technical assistance, what's called technical assistance, or consultation, or some training that's provided. I should say, based on what you both introduced this session with, is 70% of our work does involve police or law enforcement. Much of it is often around issues of excessive use of force, racial profiling, some conflict between community and law enforcement.
Can you give us an example, and aware that there, I'm sure there are certain things that you can't talk about in public, but is there an example of a recent conflict in which CRS has been called in to assist in that mediation or resolution, and what did that particular case entail?
Yeah, and certainly, like any mediator, there's certain confidentiality rules that we certainly cannot cross here. In terms of recent situations, certainly we have been in Ferguson, Missouri, since the day after the original incident took place where Michael Brown is shot. That's a situation where, similar to other situations, when there's an incident that happens, somebody from the community contacted us, and we then on that next day, the Sunday after the day it happened, drove to St. Louis, Missouri, from the Kansas City office where our folks were posted, and began working. And began working with law enforcement, began working with community groups. This is all available publicly, so again, I can share it, is that we've been facilitating dialogue between law enforcement, between government officials, with community members. We have certainly done work in terms of how parties, when they're doing the protest, to keep them safe, to making sure that groups stay within the boundaries that they need to. We've worked with the schools in the area in terms of providing a problem-solving program for them and in dealing with the issues that have come up for them. And it's, again, it's been an ongoing situation. We still have staff out there today working with community, working with officials, working with law enforcement in terms of dealing with the issues that they have.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the history of CRS? I know you talked about it earlier as kind of being born out of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that moment in the history of CRS, its founding, and, you know, what did that bill entail? What was the original vision for this division within the Department of Justice?
So the Community Relations Service would not exist but for President Lyndon Baines Johnson. He had actually proposed it in 1957 for the Civil Rights Act then. He thought that there needed to be a group of conciliators who would go and help people resolve their own issues. He's often considered one of the greatest negotiation presidents because of his ability to influence the Congress. And he thought that it was important to have parties to help in community-based situations. He asked Arthur Goldberg, the future Supreme Court Justice, to actually draft the legislation then. It was not included in the bill then. But what happened when you fast forward to the Birmingham incident, that's where Department of Justice Burke Marshall actually mediates between the parties. And a really interesting one, Andrew Young was a critical negotiator on behalf of the black businesses and black leaders in that situation. Of course, that's where there's the letter from the Birmingham jail. And Burke Marshall said, oh, we need to have this ability, but it was just too much time to mediate. It was exhausting for him to play the mediation party. There are some fascinating side stories to that one, in which the last hang-up in that negotiation was the bailing out of, I believe, many, many people who were in the jails. They actually had to go find the money. Burke Marshall actually had to go find several hundred thousand dollars. Wow. And Harry Belafonte put some of the money up.
Yeah.
Rockefeller put some of the money up. Actually, the story as I hear it, they actually took out $100,000 in cash from a bank to bring the money there. So those are two factors, right? LBJ, the primary reason exists, the fact of the success of the Birmingham situation. You think about it, it's where King and Young and others actually go against the segregation policies of Alabama, right? Birmingham agrees to desegregate, basically, and it's based on black economic power. Blacks were not shopping, and that makes it a unique actually situation out of there. So that's the second reason that they thought, hey, we need it. And the third was the 1964 Civil Rights Act was about the desegregation of public accommodations about around the hotels and restaurants. There was a great fear at the time that that may seem today may not have seemed as important, but at the time there was a concern that you couldn't, there would be all these hotels and restaurants and other public accommodations that would have these have problems if forced to desegregate. So they thought that they would not, you couldn't litigate your way out of it, and you couldn't just force law enforcement or federal troops there, but mediators could help. So that was the the third reason why CRS gets created. If it's okay, CRS, you mentioned Selma.
Yeah.
That was one of CRS's first big mediations. That's a situation, of course, where there's Bloody Sunday, where 84 people get injured, including the future Congressman John Lewis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
After that happens, LBJ sends CRS there to prevent further bloodshed. And the first director was a man named Leroy Collins, and he was a governor, a white governor out of Florida at the time, very progressive. And it's Leroy Collins and others from CRS who then mediate between Martin Luther King and the state troopers in order to prevent violence in that second march, which is actually depicted in the film in Selma, in which King leads the protest to the Pettus Bridge. And when he gets there, they kneel and they sing, "We Shall Overcome." And then he turns and goes back. That ability to do so was based on CRS mediating and with Andrew Young helping to create the agreement that to prevent violence, to get both sides to agree that when they got to the Pettus Bridge, that they could pray and that they would turn around and that Lingo and the Colonel Lingo from the state troopers would not attack them. As well. So that's a backstory that's not depicted in the film, but yeah. But one of the first major mediations that CRS is engaged in.
Wow.
Very reminiscent of a lot of Gandhian type nonviolence stories and anecdotes from the time of the Indian independence from Britain.
Right.
Could you share with us how you think your own dispute resolution and conflict management background connect with your CRS work?
Yeah. If you went to the 1964 Civil Rights Act, CRS was created by Title 10. And it basically says that CRS's job is to resolve disputes, disagreements, and differences. So at its most fundamental level, that's what CRS does. So I would say two things. It's been a great application of everything that I've learned in my career up until then. And I'm astounded by the great amount of work and the great work that the CRS staff does out there and how they've pushed my understanding of what it means to be a conflict resolution specialist. Of what it means to do this work. We talked about Roger Fisher earlier, but every day you're faced with positions and you're trying to help the community, you're trying to help law enforcement, you're trying to help educators get past those positions in highly emotional, seemingly intractable disputes. So it has served me very well to have that grounding, yeah. To face these situations day in and day out. At the same time, I have certainly learned a great deal from my amazing staff and how broadly they view their work. It's not like a labor management negotiation where, like the ones Anthony, you and I used to do together, in the sense that we knew the parties. Okay, here's who represents labor, here's who represents management. We sit at a table, maybe we pull out some flip charts, maybe we have them go into a caucus. These are much more fluid. These are who should come to the table, how many should come to the table, right. How do you deal with media, and there's it's so fluid in that you're doing the work. Maybe you're doing shadow diplomacy. Maybe you're calling people to get them to stop doing something. It's the activity, and it's similar to Bill Urey's book about the third way, in that there's a lot of different roles a third party can play, and CRS really does do it in a whole spectrum of ways.
You are listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. My co-host for today's show is Dr. Anthony Winnie St. John. He's the main instructor and author of the online course, Negotiation Shaping the Conflict Landscape, which the Global Campus has been offering during the month of February. And our guest today is Gran Lum. He's the director of the Community Relations Service at the United States Department of Justice.
Oh, Gran, that very fluidity you were speaking about, it reminds me a lot of what happens in the peace processes that emerge from the civil wars around the world that have plagued us, especially in the last two decades, where there's disputes over who's going to be allowed into the room and whether things will be conducted in secret or there will be a media presence. Everything is up for grabs, including the very legitimacy of negotiation itself. And one thing I learned from you when we used to do those labor management mediations was about your adaptability to the parties and the situation. And I wanted to dig in a little deeper on that adaptability. I recall specifically this 1999 or 2000 mediation that you and I were doing somewhere, probably in Illinois,
right?
Where it was the university faculty and administration that were doing their contract negotiations. And there were a lot of fiscal issues, a declining budget and increasing costs for benefits and things like that, that unions hate to have to confront and that, frankly, the boards also hated to confront. But after a couple of days of being with them and not getting too far, you asked them, do you want us to be more directive as mediators? Can we step into a more directive role? You can empower us and we can propose substantive ideas and proposals and maybe compromises for you, or we could stay in a more facilitative role. And I, you know, suddenly in that moment, my eyes opened up about how many different roles a mediator can play in the same case, in the same conflict. Obviously, in that case, they grabbed the opportunity and began to make progress immediately because you took charge of some of the substance, even though they continued to own the decisions on the substance. And that showed me that you also had a theory in your head, implicit or not, about what mediation is all about. And I wonder if we could delve into your thinking today, if we could make it explicit. What's your theory of practice in acting as a negotiator or a mediator?
Well, Anthony, I think you give me too much credit, but I'll take it.
Oh, no, I was there.
it was, and I think you were tremendous in terms of the way that you brought calmness and you brought your intellect to them, and that I think always made a difference in the work that we did together as well.
Thank you.
I'd build from what you said in the sense of the first thing I think about is related to what you just said, that is, if you ask the parties for permission, or if you just say, is it okay if we did this? Usually the parties are pretty amenable to it because they're stuck, or else they would not have had a mediator there in the first place.
Right.
And I think we've got to use that. I think it's both trusting it's the trust of the process, it's the credibility that you've built, but then that allows you to do a lot more. It allows more creativity, and it keeps the mediators safe so that you don't become distrusted by the parties. They can always say no, right?
Right, they can say no.
And I compare that maybe both to international and some of the domestic peace work that we do, in that there's often a power differential. There's certainly sometimes the perception of power differential in labor management negotiations, and it's saying there may be maybe one side, sometimes it's the community, let's put it that way. Let's say they're dealing with government officials where they may not have the sophistication or they're accustomed to being mediated or being involved in negotiations. And as a result, what happens? You get, sometimes you become more adversarial, or you're so used to protesting, or you're so used to arguing that there becomes a fear. If you don't do that, you're not doing your job, or you're not sure what happens if you open yourselves up to something new. Andrew Young actually told me that was why Martin Luther King selected him as a negotiator, that he wasn't afraid of the other side. He wasn't afraid of the white negotiators on the other side, and he felt comfortable working with them. And in those situations where we're working with, say, more sophisticated government officials, but it isn't always that way. There are certainly times when you have very sophisticated advocacy organizations,
right.
And maybe perhaps less sophisticated government officials. But taking this situation, what our conciliators might do is they might turn to all – either, again, there might be some sensitivity. You might go to the government officials and ask, is it okay if we spend a couple of hours working with the committee to get them ready for this negotiation? I think they just need some work so that they have the proposals good to go and that they understand how to make this process work for them. Versus just doing that and then being perceived as, oh, you are for the community.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to get them a bigger advantage here. By just asking for permission and then clarifying, then you're doing something that will help both sides at the end of the day. But it could be, if not done properly or if not done in an open way, perceived as, oh, you're in the bag for one side or the other.
Exactly.
The other two things I'd say are, over time, what my theory of practice has evolved into is the importance of building relationships. That in negotiations, the better you can build the relationships between key parties. It's not always the quantity or the amount of relationships. And this is reflecting a little bit of what I was listening to John Paul Lederach a little bit. I actually got a chance to talk to him for the first time a few months back, where it's the quality of the relationships between unlikely parties. If they're a key, we're in a time where it's becoming easier and easier to never talk with somebody you disagree with. It's so easy to get your echo chamber, and it's harder to get people face to face now. So I think one thing as mediators or as conflict resolution specialists we have to do is really help cement those relationships between key parties who need to work with each other. And the last thing, somewhat related to that, is are we here? I think we've got to focus not just on solving some discrete problem, but are we making some sort of sustainable change here? And I remember working in Riverside, California, at a manufacturing plant, and we did a. I remember doing. We did trades. They had three shifts, right? They had the graveyard shift, the day shift, and the morning and the evening shift, and we did training 24 at all the different time phases. I don't remember. It was very bizarre doing a training from midnight to 6 a.m. whatever it was. But when I came back there, what I was struck by was it was a labor management situation. But the management said, I don't know what you did to Ron, but he's like become the biggest advocate for you all. And it was because he had applied the learning to his own personal life. He was a self-described hothead, and he explained how. And when we talked to him, he said that it was Father's Day. He had his divorced daughter with him. They went to the restaurant at the hotel they were staying at. They didn't have reservations, and usually he would blow up. But this time, what he did was he went to the interest and said, here's what happened. This is Father's Day. I don't get to see my daughter very often. Here's her dilemma. And what happened, he said, oh, the restaurant said, we'll bring you room service to your room. I think they even gave a free meal or something. And his daughter saw him totally differently. And he brought that personal learning to the workplace, and it helped create a sustainable change in that environment.
That's a powerful story, and I want to follow it up in a couple of minutes with another issue about mediators. But first, there's a question from one of our participants.
Okay.
Yes, Grant, this question is for you. It comes from our listener, Russia, who actually just joined the negotiation course earlier this week. So I'm really thankful that she's popping in here and asking us these questions. So we were chatting online, and the question is, how can practitioners build or offer a framework in negotiation that addresses the relationship between identity and culture? So specifically, identity issues and culture-based conflicts. And the example provided was the Muslim community integration in France.
So that's a great question. Thank you for that. And CRS's work for much of its history was around race, color, and national origin. Since 2009, with the passage of the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act, our job has also been to respond and prevent hate crimes based on race, color, national origin, gender, gender identity, religion, sexual orientation, and disability. And really, for quite a bit of time now, we've been working on that issue, working in the United States. Now, just to be clear, our jurisdiction is purely domestic, so we would not work in France, but we have been doing that work here. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly been quite a few incidents of hate crimes, backlash violence against people who are Arab, Muslim, Sikh, South Asian, and perceived as such. And our folks have been doing really amazing work there. The work that we've done to help in that type of situation includes the following. We have done a lot of cultural competency or cultural professionalism training. We've created videos on it. We actually work with a lot of law enforcement on that issue to help them understand the Sikh religion, for example, so we will actually have some, we work with a number of the Sikh organizations, and someone from CRS will go, and so we'll bring someone from the organization to talk about that. And I've been in these, I was in Worcester, Massachusetts at a police academy with all these new recruits, and we provided them with a program on the Sikh religion, for example, and it makes a difference. So there's that sort of work that we're doing. We have certainly played the bridge role between Somalian communities, Muslim communities, and local law enforcement. We will often introduce the U.S. attorneys. When U.S. attorneys come in every 2 years, we often do meetings with them. It's so important, especially when there hasn't been an incident, there hasn't been these sort of problems, is to make sure that people are meeting, important community leaders are meeting. We often help different folks from communities and emerging communities like the Hmong communities, and certainly different communities in being a part of a human relations commission locally, in getting involved in task forces. That then you start to build the infrastructure there, and you want to work with the different advocacy organizations in working with them to build it up. An important part is reporting. We do not get enough reporting on hate crimes. We work very closely with the Civil Rights Division, with the FBI, for the hate crimes reporting to actually disaggregate some of that. So now we have more categories on different religious categories as well, including Hindu, including Sikh, including various different religions, so that we have a better understanding of that. And it's going to be important to work with the communities to increase reporting. So there's a lot, I think, that has to be done in terms of bridging communities, in getting folks involved in their communities, in working with law enforcement, educators, government officials. That's a long answer. It's not an easy task, and given what happened in Paris, given what happened in North Carolina, given the threats that are the Mall of America, this is going to continue to be a significant issue in this country and throughout the world. So it's something that we're going to have to spend, all of us are going to have to spend more time and more energy working on.
There is no lack of need in our world for dispute resolution and conflict resolution competencies. I wanted to build on something that we were talking about a little while ago and make the observation that in our mediation work that I did with you, I was initially shocked at how sticky conflict can be and how persistent the conflict parties often were about trying to get the mediator to take a side. And sometimes not even doing it very overtly. It would be very subtle, but it would be a way to get you, to become a partisan and thereby reduce your ability to be effective as a neutral, but in their view, increase their power as one of the conflict parties. And I'm wondering if you have, observed that stickiness, that trap that mediators can occasionally fall into, and how it might impact the CRS type work.
And Anthony, unfortunately, I couldn't hear the first half or so of your question. Can you quickly repeat that?
Oh, yeah. It was about how I've observed that mediators can be easily drawn into the partisanship of a conflict because the parties sometimes consciously or unconsciously try to get you to take their side.
Right.
And I occasionally found myself being drawn into one side or the other in my early mediation experiences. Mm-hmm. And had to take steps to shield myself against being, adopted by one side as part of their artillery against the other side.
Sure.
And maintain the integrity of the mediation.
And sure.
I wondered if you'd observe that as well.
Absolutely. It's incredibly important for our conciliators to be impartial, to be neutral, to be unbiased, and also to be perceived as such. And we are dealing in highly polarized situations where there's a lot of emotion going on. And one thing I would start with as an important place to start is, to the extent that you can, work in teams, right?
Right.
You and I, Anthony, we worked in a team because I think that provides some balancing to this. As well, it actually allows you several opportunities to talk offline, to do some reality checking, to have somebody observing while one person is more in the lead role in a mediation or in facilitating a conflict. I think it's absolutely critical in doing so. We even focus on our language usage as we talk to folks, right? To being facilitative is a technique to draw folks out, but it's also a safer way to stay neutral,
right?
To actually be neutral in the words that you use so that you're careful about what the words are that are coming from your mouth and how they are being heard. We all walk into situations, the previous question was on identity. These are very hard issues that have to do with identity conflict. Sometimes they can be the hardest things because no one wants to compromise their religion. Nobody wants to compromise their race. I think it's a crucial thing to have that check-in. We also have a manager for our conciliators, and it's considered pretty important that they be reporting back on a very regular basis so that there's that check-in point, especially if we're a lean operation, so we can't always operate in teams. So having that manager in place, looking at their work and providing oversight and perspective is important as well.
That's a very interesting way to run the organization to make sure there are those check-in points. I was in a training for USIP maybe a couple of weeks ago, helping folks who are U.S. government civilians deploying to Afghanistan in an advisory capacity, and going through my usual negotiation training module with them. And around halfway through it, one of our participants gets up and says, I know this interest-based stuff, and I'm good at developing options with people, and I like to measure things according to, you know, legitimacy and criteria, and I always try to figure out what the BATNAs of the different sides are, but don't try this at home. And he, you know, he said it sort of half-jokingly, but the whole class erupted into laughter without a lot of discussion. But there seemed to be something in it about what, you know, what are some of the challenges and difficulties in bringing conflict resolution skills and practices into our domestic life, into our families, into our business partnerships and other professional engagements. So I wanted to ask you, how can we create stronger families, stronger professional working relationships that allow us to manage conflicts in the healthiest way possible?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a great question, Anthony, and I am certainly a believer that family is the most important thing in life. And I would say the stakes, sometimes we all, the stakes are lower, but they're actually, I think, higher.
Yeah, they're higher in many ways.
With your family. And yeah, it's funny when you say, oh, what are your interests and options? When you say it to your family, they're going, what are you doing? I, my wife, as you know, Anthony's a marriage family therapist. And when you're a therapist, people say the same thing. Don't try that stuff on me, right?
Exactly.
Somewhat similar. And I would say it's true for, I won't speak to my wife's work. I'll let her speak to that. I don't want to get in trouble with her, right? So I'll speak to my work in that I see the elements of negotiation. It can serve us well not as a alphabet soup or a 1-2-3-4 recipe, but as a compass, right? Uh-huh. As something that can provide as guidance to something. But when used artificially or when used without heart and when used, whether consciously or unconsciously, to manipulate somebody else, then it can be used for in a way that will cause harm to your family, right? Yeah, if I'm a smart person, I can use my negotiation techniques to manipulate. But if that's what is the actual outcome, then you have failed. Because I don't care how good your techniques or tools are, if you haven't done your own identity work as a husband or as a father or as a son, and if you're not putting your heart into it, then the outcome will be poor. And these are lifelong relationships. I mean, it can't just be about short-term gain. It will come back to haunt you. And so I think that I found the tools incredibly helpful in terms of, I don't think I could do half the things I do, both personally and professionally. I think they've made a huge difference, but I would never say they're a substitute for caring, for attention, and for what goes on, the care that one has. Those things, if they are used to disguise it, it doesn't work. If they're used to bring them out, then you can have stronger families, and then you can have better relationships.
It's been the most challenging context for me to apply these principles and practices in the home, and I'm always, you know, challenging myself to do better there and bring more heart into the way I parent or to the way I am as a son. Or as a husband.
Yeah, I agree with that. Grand, you know, besides personal biases and stereotypes, we still live in a world where collective discrimination and ideologies of hatred exist. Many of the civil wars of the past two decades, there's been an element of targeting a population or a community based on their identity. And this was sometimes incited by leaders who could focus blame for real or imagined grievances on that target group, you know, the other. Wars in Bosnia, Rwanda, Burundi, Darfur, South Sudan, etc. When we talk about those here in the United States, it's happening over there. Are we immune to such phenomena here in the United States? I mean, are those things happening in the United States? We just don't focus on it as much?
I would certainly say that the wars that are going out in Bosnia, Rwanda, South Sudan, those are really, they're heartbreaking, right? They are heartbreaking situations where you are targeting people purely because of who they are. And we've got to remember they are human and we are human. So I don't think we're immune from, if I took a step back, from bias and stereotype, it's certainly, I would say it still operates here, and that we can talk about, you know, the work that we do, where there are clearly perceptions. There are perceptions of distrust and of discrimination and of profiling by African Americans of what law enforcement is doing. And at the same time, we have to look at it from law enforcement. I would have to say most law enforcement, I've come to work with a lot of police chiefs and meet a lot of folks who are rank and file, and most of them are incredibly hardworking, incredibly committed to what they do, and they have perceptions and they have concerns about who they're working with as well. It is clearly, there is a gulf of understanding. There are real issues that have to be dealt with as well. So we've got to work on our own, I believe as a country in the United States, we have to work on our own issues too.
Thank you.
So Grant, we're coming to the end of our show here. This has been absolutely wonderful to hear from your stories and the work you do at CRS. So we want to know, before we kind of end, what's next for you? What's next for Grand Lum? What are some visions you have or goals that you'd like to accomplish, even if they're not related to your profession?
Well, I'd love to spend more time with my family. we can go to that. I'm really happy here at CRS. It has been a once in a lifetime opportunity to work with amazing staff members who do a special, unique work in terms of working with different communities throughout this country, and to be able to work with issues like the transgender issue, to help people who are extraordinarily appreciative where there are real issues of where transgender individuals are targeted, where there are issues of how law enforcement interacts with individuals who are transgender, and to provide that has been that sort of work has been some of the most gratifying work I've done in my entire career. Hey, beyond that, beyond family and all that, I just want to go to somewhere where I can continue to bring some sort of value. If I can go to places where I can continue to do this work in some way, that would be great, whether it's resolving conflicts, helping create sustained change. I've had the chance in this administration to work on issues of poverty and race and hate crimes and conflict. I do think for your listeners here and for the U.S. Institute of Peace, you know, we are in the business of working on polarized disputes. I do think I would be thrilled if I could continue to help promote that, right? To the importance of dialogue and of creating deeper relationships between unlikely parties, people who need to work each other. I think it's something we have to get out there, all of us have to be out there together promoting and sharing the value of this because it's very much needed out in the world.
Thank you very much. Our guest today has been Grand Lum. He's the director of the Community Relations Service at the United States Department of Justice. Grand, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you, Darren and Anthony. It was a pleasure talking with both of you.
My co-host today has been Dr. Anthony Wanese St. John. Anthony, as always, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Darren, and thank you, Grand, for all you've taught me personally and for the opportunities I've had to work with you and learn from you and for your time with us today.
You have been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. Be sure to check out and register for our next course launching on Monday, Demystifying, Monitoring, and Evaluation for Peacebuilding Practitioners. Our producers are Leah Collins, Vanessa Francis, Kara Stevens, and Peter Weinberger. Our sound engineer and theme music composer is Blake Mobley. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. And I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Thanks to our listeners for your questions and comments. Until then, keep learning, supporting, and building peace.